BBC Radio 2.
2, the next instalment in our series of Ian Fleming's James Bond stories. Damian Lewis reads part one of For Your Eyes Only.
In London, October had begun with a week of brilliant Indian summer, and the noise of the mowers came up from Regent's Park and in through the wide open windows of M's office. Bond had been asked if he had anything on at the moment, and he had replied happily that he hadn't, and had waited for Pandora's box to be opened for him. He was mildly intrigued because M had addressed him as James and not by his number, 007. This was unusual during duty hours. It sounded as if there might be some personal angle to this assignment, as if it might be put to him more as a request than as an order. And it seemed to Bond that there was an extra small cleft of worry between the frosty, damnably clear grey eyes. M swiveled his chair round square with the desk and flung the box of matches down so that it skidded across the red leather top towards Bond. Bond fielded it and skidded it politely back to the middle of the desk. M smiled briefly. He seemed to make up his mind. He said mildly, "James, has it ever occurred to you that every man in the fleet knows what to do except the commanding admiral?" Bond frowned. He said, "It hadn't occurred to me, sir, but I see what you mean. The rest only have to carry out orders. The Admiral has to decide on the orders. And I suppose it's the same as saying that Supreme Command is the loneliest post there is." M jerked his pipe sideways. Same sort of idea. Someone's got to be tough. Someone's got to decide in the end. If you send a havering signal to the Admiralty, you deserve to be put on the beach. Some people are religious, pass the decision on to God. M's eyes were defensive. I used to try that sometimes in the service, but he always passed the buck back again, told me to get on and make up my own mind. Good for one, I suppose, but tough. Trouble is, very few people keep tough after about 40. They've been knocked about by life, had troubles, tragedies, illnesses. These things soften you up. M looked sharply at Bond. How's your coefficient of toughness, James? You haven't got to the dangerous age yet. Bond didn't like personal questions. He didn't know what to answer, nor what the truth was. He had not got a wife or children, had never suffered the tragedy of a personal loss. He had not had to stand up to blindness or a mortal disease. He had absolutely no idea how he would face these things that needed so much more toughness than he had ever had to show. He said hesitantly, "I suppose I can stand most things if I have to and if I think it's right, sir. I mean..." He did not like using such words. "If the cause is, sort of just, sir." He went on, feeling ashamed at himself for throwing the ball back at M. "Of course, it's not easy to know what is just and what isn't. I suppose I assume that when I'm given an unpleasant job in the service, the cause is a just one." "Damn it!" M's eyes glittered impatiently. "That's just what I mean. You rely on me. You won't take any damned responsibility yourself." He thrust the stem of his pipe towards his chest. "I'm the one who has to decide if a thing is right or not." The anger died out of the eyes. The grim mouth bent sourly. He said gloomily, "Oh, well, I suppose it's what I'm paid for. Somebody's got to drive the bloody train." Now Bond felt sorry for M. He had got himself a problem. Bond wondered what it was. It would not be concerned with danger. If M could get the odds more or less right, he would risk anything, anywhere in the world. It would not be political. M did not give a damn for the susceptibilities of any ministry, and thought nothing of going behind their backs to get a personal ruling from the Prime Minister. It might be moral. It might be personal. Bond said, "Is there anything I can help over, sir?" M looked briefly, thoughtfully at Bond, and then swiveled his chair so that he could look out of the window at the high summery clouds. He said abruptly, "Do you remember the Havelock case?"
"Only what I read in the papers, sir."
"Elderly couple in Jamaica. The daughter came home one night and found them full of bullets. There was some talk of gangsters from Havana. The housekeeper said three men had called in a car. But as far as I remember, the police didn't get anywhere." "That's all, sir. I haven't seen any signals passing on the case." M said gruffly, "You wouldn't have. They've been personal to me. We weren't asked to handle the case. Just happens." M cleared his throat.
This private use of the service was on his conscience. I knew the Havelocks. Matter of fact, I was best man at their wedding. Malta, 1925.
I see, sir. That's bad.
I got the whole story a couple of weeks ago. A man called Hammerstein or von Hammerstein had the couple killed. There are a lot of Germans well dug in these banana republics. This one's ex-Gestapo. He got a job as head of Batista's counterintelligence. He was set up for life until Castro's lot began to make headway. He cut one of his officers in on the loot, a man called Gonzalez, and this man travelled around the Caribbean and began salting away Hammerstein's money, put it in real estate and such like. Hammerstein heard of the Havelock's property, one of the best in Jamaica, and he told Gonzalez to go and get it. I suppose his orders were to kill the Havelocks if they wouldn't sell, and then put pressure on the daughter. About 25 by now. Never seen her myself. Anyway, that's what happened. They killed the Havelocks. Then 2 weeks ago, Batista sacked Hammerstein. Hammerstein cleared out and took his little team of three with him.
Bond said softly, "Where have they gone to?"
"America. Right up in the north of Vermont. Place called Echo Lake. It's some kind of millionaire's ranch he's rented, tucked away in the mountains. And now..." M slowly swiveled his chair back square with the desk. "I've got to decide what to do next." Now Bond realised why M was troubled, why he wanted someone else to make the decision. Because these had been friends. M was thinking, is this justice or is it revenge? Bond said, "I wouldn't hesitate for a minute, sir. If foreign gangsters find they can get away with this kind of thing, they'll decide the English are as soft as some people seem to think we are. This is a case for rough justice,
an eye for an eye."
M went on looking at Bond. He gave no encouragement, made no comment.
Bond said, "These people can't be hung, sir, but they ought to be killed."
M's eyes ceased to focus on Bond. For a moment they were blank, looking inward. Then he slowly reached for the top drawer of his desk, pulled it open and extracted a thin file. He rummaged again in the drawer. The hand brought out a rubber stamp and a red ink pad. M opened the pad, tamped the rubber stamp on it and then pressed it down on the grey cover. He turned and pushed it gently across the desk to Bond. The red sans-serif letters, still damp, said, "For your eyes only." Bond said nothing. He nodded and picked up the docket and walked out of the room. Two days later, Bond took the Friday Comet to Montreal. He did not care for it. It flew too high and too fast, and there were too many passengers. Only 8 hours after leaving London, Bond was driving a Hertz U-Drive Plymouth saloon along the broad Route 17 from Montreal to Ottawa and trying to remember to keep on the right of the road. The headquarters of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police are alongside Parliament buildings in Ottawa. Bond had been told to ask at the front desk for the commissioner and to give his name as Mr. James. He did so, and a young fresh-faced corporal took him up in the lift to the third floor. When he was shown in through the connecting door, a tall, youngish man in a dark blue suit, white shirt and black tie, turned away from the window and came towards him. "Mr. James?" The man smiled thinly.
"I'm Colonel, let's say, Johns." They shook hands.
"Come along and sit down. The commissioner is very sorry not to be here to welcome you himself.
He has a bad cold. You know, one of those diplomatic ones."
Bond smiled. The commissioner was glad to help, but he was going to handle this with kid gloves. There would be no comeback on his office. He said, "I quite understand. When I go out of here, we'll forget each other, and if I end up in Sing Sing, that's my worry."
"Well, now."
Colonel Johns opened a drawer in his desk and took out a bulging file. The top document was a list. He put his pencil on the first item and looked across at Bond. He ran his eye over Bond's old black and white houndstooth tweed suit and white shirt and thin black tie. He said, "Clothes." He unclipped a plain sheet of paper from the file and slid it across the desk. "This is a list of what I reckon you'll need. Khaki shirt, dark brown jeans, good climbing boots or shoes, and walnut stain. Buy a gallon and give yourself a bath in the stuff. There are plenty of browns in the hills at this time and you won't want to be wearing parachute cloth or anything that smells of camouflage. Rifle. Went down myself and put it in the boot of your Plymouth while you were waiting. One of the new Savage 99Fs. Oh, by the way." Colonel Johns looked up from his list. "You carrying a personal gun?"
"Yes.
Walter PPK in a Burns Martin holster. Right, give me the number. I got a blank license here. If that gets back to me, it's quite okay. I got a story for it. Bond took out his gun and read off the number. Colonel Johns filled in the form and pushed it over. Now then, maps. Here's a local SO map that's all you need to get you to the area. Colonel Johns got up and walked round with the map to Bond and spread it out. Whole trip shouldn't take you more than 5 hours, including stops, okay? Johns went back to his chair and took two more pieces of paper off the file. The first was a scrap of penciled map, the other a section of aerial photograph. He said, looking seriously at Bond, "Now, here are the only inflammable things you'll be carrying, and I gotta rely on you getting rid of them just as soon as they've been used, or at once if there's a chance of you getting into trouble. This," he pushed the paper over, "is a rough sketch of an old smuggling route from Prohibition days. You get across country here, over a couple of highways. Then you're over a steep range and down into the top of the valley you want. The cross is Echo Lake, and judging from the photographs, I'd be inclined to come down on top of it from the east. Got it? What's the distance? About 10 miles? 10 and a half. Colonel Johns pushed over the square of aerial photograph. It showed a long, low range of well-kept buildings made of cut stone. On the garden side was a stone-flagged terrace, and beyond this, 2 or 3 acres of trim lawn stretched down to the edge of the small lake. Echo Lake looked what it was, the luxurious retreat in deep country of a millionaire who liked privacy. The lake was also convenient for washing blood off hands. The two men got to their feet. Colonel Johns took Bond to the door and held out his hand. He said, "Well, I guess that's all. So long and the best of luck. No doubt I'll read all about it in the papers." He smiled. "Whichever way it goes." Bond shook hands. A last question occurred to him. He said, "By the way, is the Savage single pull or double? I won't have a chance of finding out, and there may not be much time for experimenting when the target shows." "Single pull, and it's a hair trigger. Keep your finger off until you're sure you've got him. And keep outside 300 if you can. I guess these men are pretty good themselves. Don't get too close." He reached for the door handle. His other hand went to Bond's shoulder. "Our commissioner's got a motto. Never send a man where you can send a bullet. You might remember that. So long, Commander." Bond spent the night and most of the next at the Cozy Motor Court outside Montreal. When darkness came, he had dinner and then diluted the walnut stain and washed himself all over with the stuff. He came out looking like a red Indian with blue-grey eyes. Just before midnight, he drove off to Freiligsburg. He stopped on the far side of the town and found the dirt track running off into the woods. The springy, cushioned soles of the climbing boots were wonderful to walk on. By 5 o'clock, he had crossed the black rivers of U.S. highways 108 and 120. Now he was on the last lap, a small hunting trail that climbed steeply. Well away from the highway, he stopped and shifted his rifle and knapsack around, had a cigarette and burned the sketch map. Bond visualized the house deep down in the little valley. He saw the blank curtained windows, the crumpled sleeping faces of the four men, and here, on the other side of the mountain, was the executioner coming up through the trees. Bond closed his mind to the picture, trod the remains of his cigarette into the ground, and got going.
Part 1 of For Your Eyes Only by Ian Fleming was read by Damian Lewis and produced by Joanna Green. The executive producer was Liz Anstey, and it was a Celador production for BBC Radio 2. You can hear the concluding part at the same time next week.